big, and thank you, Rabbi Brand, or the Asher Rabbi Engel, of course, my dear distinguished colleague, Rav Ries, has come all the way from New York, a very early flight, I imagine, and of course, Professor Reznikov, all distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. Now, first of all, I have to issue a disclaimer. What is the disclaimer? Based on the fact that generally, my role in the community is to be a rabbinic decisor. I have to give a psak, or a decision. And people are many times make me famous by quoting me of making decisions that I never made. That's how I become famous. So I just want to say that this discussion this morning is not one that making absolute decisions. I will present the specific topic and a lot of some of the material that goes into it. It's a very vast topic. The more I've looked into it, and even looking at that which was circulated, the sheets of the Talmudic and rabbinic sources, it's really impossible to go through all of it in detail. I just try to give the gist and a presentation of a subject matter which is fair competition and commerce regulation, American and Jewish law. Now, first of all, I will try to illustrate some of the basic and very simple outline that we find in the text of the Gemara, of the Talmud, in Bava Basra, on Daf Chaf Aleph Amud Beis, which is there printed. For those who have learned or learn the Daf Yomi, the daily page folios of the Talmud, took care of this, studied this perhaps a few months ago, but there is the text. Basically, the text contains a situation. Now, what I've noticed going over this several times, there are no verses from the Torah that are quoted. When we speak about competition or intrusion on someone else's right of business, or trying to eliminate it or to reduce it, what we call the element of competition. There's one store here, and another store opens up right near it. How is it going to damage that, and so forth? But in the entire discussion in the Gemara, they do not mention one verse, and yet a phrase is used. When Jews talk about this situation, if they have any understanding, or if they have heard, that this is called Hasogas Gvul, which in the Torah, in the Sedra of Shoftim, talks about actual property, and we might call it a sort of claim jumping, or illegal extension of a boundary into someone else's property, where if there's a boundary line, and someone moves it 6 inches, a foot, 2 feet over to someone else's property, and he claims that all belongs to me. In fact, that once happened to me in Borough Park years ago. With someone building a house next door, and it was right off my driveway, just to illustrate that. And regrettably, these were Hasidic builders and so forth, and I see they're drawing this line. It's going over, encroaching on my own property, so I called their attention. And after fumbling a bit, they moved it back where it was supposed to be. So that's the traditional understanding of Hasogas Gvul, of literal interpretation. But what we have here is, and they don't use any psukim, and even the early sources don't relate that to business competition in the sources that comment on the Torah. But here it's taken just as seems to be a concept of fairness, of being fair, and it works with principles of logic that are debated, especially in this first text, in the tractate in the Masechta Bava Basra, between two Amoraim, two later teachers in the Talmudic literature, Rav Huna and Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua. What is this basic text? Now, this basic text may also call your attention to a most, and I met the individual that authored this, and I regard him as a brilliant person as far as law and advisor of law, Dr. Nachum Rockover. Dr. Nachum Rockover his official status with the Israeli government, with the Memshalah, was a Yoetz Mishpati. He was a legal consultant to the Attorney General's office in Israel, but mostly to bring in Talmudic sources of Torah law and of rabbinic law. And why was that considered very necessary? Because this is something that the late Rav Herzog, the second chief rabbi of Israel, and he was the first chief rabbi after the state was established, was pushing for going away from mandate law in the state of Israel. Mandate law consisted of a combination of the Code Napoleon and also of Turkish law. Both together formed what they called mandate law. And he wanted to go away from use of that type of law, which would be considered from a Jewish standpoint a secular type of system, and come back to what became known as Mishpat Ivri, growing Jewish law based on Talmudic and rabbinic sources, and reform the whole codes that it would more or less coincide or be congruent with Jewish law that we have in the Jewish codes of law. We have the Shulchan Aruch, but how do you extrapolate from that to fit into modern situations? So Dr. Rockover, who I met, he came here to Chicago a little over 10 years ago, and I met with him, very impressed. And he has issued, during the time that he served as the Yoetz Mishpati, several chovrot, many brochures on various topics in law and Mishpat Ivri and how they relate to present day. So one of those topics, which I draw a lot of his, that's a good source, if you know Hebrew, I don't know whether it's ever been translated in English, is a choveret halichot hamischar, the conduct of business there, and underneath he has in a subtitle this concept of hasagas gvul, of going into someone else's turf, so to speak, in business practices, reducing that person's profit or eliminate him. Is it possible to do this or not possible? And he outlines, of course, he brings the Talmudic sources, and we're familiar with that. The basic Talmudic source there in Bava Basra describes the following, and I'll try to reduce it in view of the time elements that we have a constrained time, is that Ravuna said, he takes a situation, you have a community. The community, the way it's structured in the Talmudic times, the way it is, you have streets, which is a Rishus HaRabim, public thoroughfare, and you have, of course, private property, Rishus HaYochi, and then you have something, what we would call today a cul-de-sac, an alley. And the alley is three sides, but you can't go through. We have plenty of them. Near where I live in West Rogers Park, there are several of those that there's no exit. You can go through and you have to stop. You can't go through all the way. Now, let's say there you have residents in that place. So he starts out, Rav Huna, by saying, if there's a resident of this mavri, of this cul-de-sac, that, for example, he has a mill, a grind, he's milling flour, whatever it is, another fellow comes, another one who is a neighbor or lives in that community, and he sets up also a mill to get customers, and so it seems to be a threat to the first original party. So according to Rav Huna, he can stop him. Dinahu. Dina means the logic is that he can stop him from opening up another place, because he can say, he uses the term kopaskas li chiyusi. You are ruining, you're taking away my livelihood. Your competition that you're bringing in is taking away my livelihood. It's a general term. Whether it's 100% true or not, we're not saying that. He says, you're taking away my chiyus, my life. You're taking away my livelihood. So he says he can stop it. And then he goes on further. It's a whole discussion back and forth where the Gemara brings in, the Talmud brings in different situations. And later on, it comes here different opinions. And the other opinions are that the individual, for example, where you have a situation in the same cul-de-sac where maybe Rabbuna is holding, it has an opinion like an earlier teacher of the Talmud of Yehuda, that let's say you have a storekeeper, and in order to attract customers, he hands out parched corn, popcorn, nuts, different things to children, and they'll go there. A parent says, oh, there's such a nice man, he has a store, let's go buy there. So he's attracting customers. So someone else says, well, who has a similar type of stores, how can you do that? So the answer there is, however, in the Gemara tells us, he says, well, I'm giving out these things, you can give out also things. You have the same right to do that. Now, I'm not taking away directly from you. You have the possibility of doing that. And fundamentally what he's saying, each one does what they can in their own. That's what the Gemara comes and says that. So later, Gemara brings a text that is talking about many different things where someone, for example, even has a store or has a bathhouse, a mech, a private bathhouse from which he gets fees. And he opens, another one comes and opens up a store next to the other one. He opens up a store, he opens up another bathhouse, another one. So that text says very clearly that he can't stop him. So there's a contradiction. One text against another. So what is the answer? How do they explain that? He says, well, I'm doing what in my place. I have my business, you have your business. You take care of your business, I'll take care of my business. That's the way they discuss it. It doesn't say that you're taking away from my earning or my way that I would be able to make an existence or so forth. And this goes back and forth, and what we have is the opinion of, so that was the opinion of Rav Huna, however, was, the Ameir was that he cannot open up a competing store or business in that cul-de-sac, in that mavui, because it will take him away from his livelihood. So Rav Huna b'Rebbe Rav Yeshua, that's part of the confusing aspect. Both of them have the same name, Rav Huna, but the other one is Rav Huna, the son of Rav Yeshua, comes and says and makes a sweeping statement and says and gives up many rules. The rules is that, first of all, that if a man comes from another town into this community where there's already previous stores that have certain type of business, so the community or the man that owns that store in this town can stop him from coming. However, if he pays taxes in the community, then he has a right to come into the community. And then he says also further, bringing it down into the cul-de-sac or so forth, that in the same cul-de-sac, he cannot stop him as long as he's a neighbor, he's living there. And the type of complaint that he has, well, you're taking away my livelihood, so the response seems to be, according to Rav Huna b'Rav Yeshua, you try to make a living in your store, and I try to live in you make a living in my store. I'm not directly taking away completely from what you have. So there's two basic opinions. Whether he can stop him from competing or not. That's the whole concept. And the overriding idea in the back of it all is he diminishing or destroying his parnasa, his income. So it seems that there's a following difference, and that's brought out later in the later rabbinic authorities, in the earlier decisives like the Tur in the 15th century and later in the Shulchan Aruch and so forth, is that there's a difference. To lessen the amount of profit that the person makes is not considered destroying his parnasa. He won't make so much as he had before. Before, actually, he had a sort of, let's say, in that cul-de-sac itself, a monopoly. There was no other store. So he was the only one. He could do practically whatever. He had no competition. Someone else comes in, gives a competition. So if his income is reduced, according to Rav Huna, the son of Rav Yeshua, and that's the way the Maimonides rules and others, that absolutely that he is allowed to do that. He's allowed to compete. However, in the later authorities come and say, it's brought down in the Shulchan Aruch in section Parav 156, Kuf Nun Vav, there, where it's stated that if he will eliminate the other party, if by opening up this door he will eliminate the other party, then he would not be allowed, even according to Avuna Beit Yehoshua. What is the illustration in the cul-de-sac? The illustration is this. The one that had the store first in the cul-de-sac was at the end, where the dead end was. So customers had to come through the whole alley, the whole street, we'll call it a street, with the dead end street, and go to the storekeeper. If the new arrival opens up right by the entry, and he has the same business, they were not going to walk down the block. They see, here's the store. They'll go right in. They will ultimately eliminate the other one from even being able to have a viable type of store that will keep going. So on that basis, the principle is that if it will involve the total elimination of the other one's business, and of course, who will have to decide that? These matters would probably have to come to Beis Din, the rabbinic courts, to understand that. But basically, that's what the concept is if that happens under those particular circumstances. Now, so that's a case that was described by using the cul-de-sac itself. And then, this idea of eliminating the business is confirmed in later actual cases that are brought in the responsa of the Chassam Sefer. The Chassam Sefer, the great rabbinic decisor in the early part of the 19th century, whom Rav Soloveitchik Zal called the engineer of halacha. In other words, he wasn't just an academic, but he was able to grasp all the academic principles that you have outlined in the earlier sources and apply them to actual cases. For example, the Chassam Sefer has a particular, to give one example of a case that he has, is where someone that was a young man, who had opened up here's what it was. First, there was a man that he was a purveyor of meat, and he was selling kosher meat to a community. And then he left that business and went away for a while. During the interim, this young man, unmarried man, because it played a role later on, opened up a business in the same place. And he claimed he paid the government tax. That was the government of the probably Austro-Hungarian government at that time that was necessary to open such a store. The original man came back and says, "What are you doing over here? This was my business. I just had might call a sabbatical or interim. I went away. I have a right to have to keep this particular business." And he brought him into the business. The other one said, "If you take over the business that I just restarted, you'll destroy me. I'll be completely eliminated." So the Chassam Sefer ruled that young fellow that had restarted the business can continue because the other one would completely eliminate him from that particular business. Although he had already seen to abandon his business, so he might be able to have the same degree of complaint and say, "Well, when you went in, you prevent me from going back." He could have started up a business somewhere else, but in the question, this question where he would have been completely eliminated, he was not allowed to do that. He also has other cases. He has in one of his responses a very extensive discussion of all of those particular aspects of trying to eliminate someone from a complete business or a situation where he would threaten the other one's parnasa, or even ultimately making it possible that the other one be eliminated. Now, I'm going to mention in my own experience in Beis Din, both in New York and in Chicago, of actual cases that took place where the Bezdin also has to deal with a realistic thing. We have to understand that part of the situation competing is not just between the two parties who are involved in where you have a plaintiff and you have a respondent or defendant, but also concerned with the protection of the community. A community deserves certain that there are certain purveyors or whatever they are serving the community. We have to see how the community will be served. That's part of the insight of the Bezdin, has to deal with that. How do we deal with that particular case? So there was a case that took place where it had to do with a question of competition. There was a restaurant in the five-town area in the Long Island. You know, those five famous five towns. This one was in Cedarhurst, not Woodmere. In Cedarhurst, there was a restaurant, full-service restaurant. It used to be called, I believe it was called Jacob's Ladder. That was the name of the restaurant. So it was on the main street. Now, a business in Queens, which is out of the county even, wanted to open up, and they were called, I think they're still in existence, called Chapanash. That's what it's called. Fast service restaurant. You walk in, and they'll serve you a quick takeout, what we call a takeout place. So they wanted to open up a place on the same street, just a block away from this other full-service restaurant. The full-service restaurant called them Ledeen before Bezdin America. I think that was before Rabbi Reis even became the Menahel of the Bezdin, long time ago. And they came in, and each one also had a toeing. Before we established the rules of only having attorneys, they had a rabbinic pleader on each side, back and forth. So what was the Bezdin's ruling? We distinguished that both places could stay open and how one would not totally threaten the other. What was it? We said that Jacob's Ladder was a full-service restaurant. You come in, you sit down with a family, you're served with waiters and everything else, and also did catering. Catering outside the premises of the restaurant. The Chapanash, who wanted to come in, was a fast food place, but they wanted to do outside catering too on request, and also wanted to set up a lot of tables there in the place. So the Bezdin, in order to make sure that both were able to survive, at least within the understanding of Bezdin, and also they would be serving the community. The community not only needed this family restaurant, but they needed also the fast food place. So the Bezdin was in the psak, in the decision, that the way they compete is within the guidelines. One is a full service, and the other one could not be a full service. The other one could not do catering, just in and out. So that's the way the balance was, because the main interest of the Bezdin at that time also was not only the question of elimination, because if that Chapanash would have coming in within part of a larger corporation, a larger group, if they were allowed to do everything that the other one, they were, I'm quite sure, was the Bezdin thought they would eliminate the other one completely. So that we're not going to allow the complete elimination, at least within reasonable understanding how the Bezdin looks at it. In another case that we had of a competing situation, possible competing, there was a pizza store, was in Bergen County, in the Teaneck area. And this goes back several decades. And another store wanted to open up fairly in the very close to vicinity. The other one complained, they're going to ruin my business or so forth. So what the Bezdin did independently, and what was the key feature was this. Since they came to the Bezdin, each party would like to have rabbinic endorsement, a heksher from the local vod of the Conference of Rabbis in that community. The local Vod would not give the heksher on the new place until the litigation was resolved. That was a very important rule, because they were thinking of the community, and they would not give a heksher on somebody that would violate the Jewish ethical or legal principles of what we call Asogas Gvul. So after consultation, Bezdin consulted with all of those, with the VOD over there, and they said the community is that sort, growing in such a manner that there's room for many other restaurants. So at that time, we said that the person could open, because one would not totally eliminate the other. There was room for both to make a livelihood. Maybe one's parnasa might have been reduced, but following that rule that is spelled out there in the Shulchan Aruch is that as long as he's not eliminated, then it would be allowed to open under that particular circumstance. So that is part of the question of the competing situation. We have the same thing happened in Chicago, where there were many times it happens, and where they come to the Chicago Rabbinical Council, who is a kashrus also endorsement agency. They want to open up another kind of facility, and the previous facility says, well, they're going to threaten my business, and because what you have generally, to speak really realistically, you have to look realistically, the original business person doesn't want any competition. Let's face the idea. I don't want any competition. I like to have it all. And if anyone coming in is going to threaten that amount of profit that he has, he's not talking about complete elimination, but when he comes into the bezin, he says he's going to destroy my business. So we understand that reality. So in most cases, we have allowed the competing party to open up a similar type of thing where we understand it would not threaten that person's particular business. There are several cases that were handled by us in dealing with that situation. And let me take something else, that how do people initially try to protect themselves? But before that, I would just like to talk about some of the things in that took place in the rabbinic courts in Israel. The rabbinic courts in Israel, where you have a system of not only of the but the dinim azorim, the district courts in the different communities, whether it's Tel Aviv, Be'er Sheva, Yerushalayim, could be Ashdod, whatever, or Haifa, all of those places have the rabbinic courts, which is part of the overreaching structure of the Rabbanut Roshit. In fact, when you see all their Piskei Dinim, all their proceedings are collected in volumes called the Piskei Dinim Azorim in different levels. There are many volumes of that. An interesting case comes up here about, and that's what we're getting into now, but I'm using that as a beginning, of a case that took place in Haifa of having to do, let's say, a business wants to protect itself from other competition. So what they try to do, let's say they had an employee, could it be whatever level, employee, a manager, whatever it was, and he wants to leave the business. He wants to go elsewhere. So they want him to sign a restrictive covenant. That's what we call it. That would restrict him from opening up a business and competing. All that he learned there, the previous business, no matter what it was, he would actually hurt the previous business one way or another. Now, we're talking about that type of thing. We're not going into other areas there, which we'll mention hopefully in a moment or two. So there was a case took place in Haifa. Someone owned a store that sold chickens. You know, the chickens were already, of course, slaughtered and so forth. It wasn't just a chicken market. People went in and bought that, kosher store, so forth and so on. There was one man that was working for them, and he left. And when he left, he was asked to sign a haskem, an agreement, hagbolot ha'esik, the restriction of going into the same kind of business. So he did sign such a document, a haskem, a haskama, and also he paid a certain amount of, he was paid a certain amount of money by the original business person. He was paid a certain amount of money that he would agree. So what happened was and the way it's described in the Psak Din, in a neighborhood adjacent to where the other store was, sure enough, the chicken store opened up. And he was in there. But he said, it doesn't belong to me, it's my son that is the one that owns the store. So in other words, he's not violating any agreement, but the facts were and was proven, he's in the store all the time. He's one of the chief operators, salesmen, direct, whatever you want to call it, managing the store. So he's brought to the Haifa Bezdin. The Haifa Bezdin ruled that since he broke the restrictive covenant, that Hagbalat HaEsek, it was considered a legal document, the way it was phrased and so forth, he not only has to move that business out of there, he has to sell to somebody else or whatever it is, get rid of it, he cannot be in there, and he has to pay back the money that he got for not competing. So what happened was, in Israel, they do have a system of an appeal system, Bet Din Le'Irurim, an appeals court. So this went to the Bet Din HaGadol of Irurim, of the appeals court in Israel. And the appeals court basically affirmed the psak of the Haifa Bezdin with one modification. They said the money that was paid, so for that Bezdin doesn't have the authority to that he should have to give back the money. But he has to not compete. They affirmed the idea of not competing. So that was a case where, of course, they discussed how the document had to be written, what the clause was, whether it was just a valid agreement or not. They went into many technicalities of rabbinic law, which is not the time and place to discuss. It would have to do with the contract and so forth. So that's one interesting case that's found in the Piskei Dinim Azurim in Israel. Then there's another case which involved, it might sound a little bit frivolous or humorous, when you think about it, you had the Taylor Shomer Hospital. And of course, the overwhelming majority of people that go to such a hospital in Israel are all Jews. And they had a big maternity section. And boys are born. So you have Moyolim, the ones who do the circumcision and so forth. So the hospital had, and it seems that they did it mostly there in the hospital at that time. Today it doesn't seem to be that often. I remember once years ago in the States, practically all brisin were done in a hospital chapel. They were, because the woman recovering from childbirth remained a whole week in the hospital. They didn't kick her out because of the medical insurance after a day or so. You know, that was a different feature of the society, how things happen. Anyhow, so they had 10 Moalim on the staff, and they rotated. They rotated. Let's say whatever was I don't know exactly, I haven't seen the actual details of the specifics of the case, whether it was on a weekly basis or whether on the number of births. Whatever it was, there was a rotation fixed at 10 Moalim. Suddenly the hospital decided to take in somebody else. Now you got 11. So the other 10 complained they're going to reduce, and of course they got fees. They were going to reduce our parnasa. This is a case of Asogas Gvul. You're intruding on our turf and so forth. So the response to that was basically, since the hospital had a right to hire whoever they wanted to or engage whoever they wanted to, and their parnasa was not eliminated. It might be reduced because you have to divide up, we would say, the whole pie into different parts and more parts, but at the same time they affirmed it because it was not a complete elimination of that. Now, when we deal with a restrictive covenant or so, we did have such a case here in Chicago years ago. And what involved was, there was a manager of a bakery who was very capable and all, and what he did was, when he left that employer, he signed a restrictive covenant that he would not either open up his own business or manage, because he was a very expert on dealing and observing, you know, how to manage a bakery. Especially the bakers are very jealous of their, at least the old-time Jewish bakeries, of their recipes. How to make a rye bread, how to make a pumpernickel. To us it seems very simple, but it's a whole art. It's a whole craft, how you do it in a very old-fashioned way. So this man signed the covenant, and sure enough, there was another bakery that was open before. He had nothing to really to do with it when it was in function. So he went in there, and he only signed a covenant not to be an owner and not to be a manager, but to work as a baker he could. So he was in that bakery, and it came out he was the working manager. He was actually, so they brought him Ledeen. However, we threw out the restrictive covenant because the lawyer, it was drawn up by a lawyer, did not say give a geographical area. You know, it's just like Stockholm, that you can't do anything. Boy, give a geographical area and say that within, for example, Cook County, you can't do this. Or DuPage County, whatever it is. Or even if you said the state of Illinois. He just left it open. That means in the whole world he can't open up anywhere in the world. So such a contract is not valid. It's what in the Chazal they would say, Dover Shayna Mesuyim. It has no boundaries. There's no boundary whatsoever. So it has to have some type of what we call a restrictive covenant that has some validity. Now, in the book that I gave out as an outline of things having to do with American law and so forth. Now, I refer to this book, which I was asked when it was in galleys to comment on for the author, who is Professor Aaron Levine. He's both a musmach, a rov, and very highly qualified in the area of both economic law, and he himself is a practicing rov, and he teaches at Yeshiva University besides. So he has a book called The Moral Issues in the Marketplace in Jewish Law. But he does a wonderful job in comparing the civil law, American law, common law, and how it relates to Jewish law. So I had indicated in the sources for, it's good homework to read that chapter, is chapter 4, Employee Agreements Not to Compete, what we call the restrictive covenant. So he, first of all, he mentions many opinions in those who are writers in the legal system. Certain professors, I'm not familiar with their stature as authorities or so forth, but he mentions one of them that says right at the outset that non-competition agreements as inherently unfair. They're unfair because the principle is it's for the benefit of the employer and inflict a burden on employees that is out of proportion to any gain. That somehow the other person is so restricted that he can't get on at all. But of course there are different things. This has to be qualified as he goes and discusses it. And he said there are 12 states, he does enumerate what they are, that have laws against restrictive covenants that do not allow. These 12 states consider them so unfair that they prohibit such agreements. Now, he does not give the source of what the 12 states are or not. I just mentioned a case that came before the Bezin. We didn't go into the question whether it's prohibited in the state of Illinois or not. But that's what he points out. But he says that in the common law, that when judges, in other words, this is left more in states where this would be allowed, the judges can't rely on some legislative act or statute or law that is there. They could look up the law and know how to apply it. They have to use judicial discretion or go off at a different, whichever way they have, into common law, whether on the basis of being fair, what type of damage is done, what type of damage is not done. And he does mention the fact that in other places, such restrictive covenants will be absolutely fair to everybody, because let's say you have a company that has certain very sensitive information, and some information that is essential to the progress of that company, and you have some employee that was trained into that. If he leaves and he has in possession all of this information, but that information used somewhere else could destroy the previous company. So there's a right of the company to protect what they call its intellectual material possessions, and also the proprietary control of those particular, what we'd say, industry secrets or whatever they might be. That is all part where that would be perhaps allowed. And he has a very lengthy description of all different cases that have come up, and of course he goes into the details when we deal with many of the actual cases that took place. Now, I just would like to represent another situations here in dealing with the aspect of the common law, of competition. There is a principle that is mentioned right there in the Gemara, in the Talmud. What happens when it comes to schools, to, let's say, religious schools, Talmud Torah, or so forth? So you have someone that is a teacher, or he has a school, and he is teaching, has classes, and so forth. Someone else comes, even in the neighborhood, and opens up another school. Is that considered a question of competition, or so forth? So there, the Talmud makes a very important statement, that where you have rival competition in the study of the Torah, kinas seifrin tar b'chachma, the envy or the jealousy, the competition of one to the other will increase the standard of learning. And that's what you have, and you see that true in many places. You might have one yeshiva that has a certain standard of learning, but if they hear that the next yeshiva, even might be in the net, that opened up in the neighborhood or not too far, has increased certain elements of their curriculum which were not included in the first ones, or adding an extra hour, so the first yeshiva feels compelled, we have to also do that. Otherwise, they'll say we're better than you are. That keeps going on. Of course, sometimes my own personal opinion is perfectly 100% destructive, because people sometimes go beyond the confines of what others actually, potentially, people are capable of doing. So what happens in the case, for example, of a... So that, they see, it seems from the Talmud and later rabbinic literature, that there's no restriction on it. Kinas seifrin tar b'chachma. It says that the jealousy or the envy of one school, of one group of teachers, will raise the level of learning. However, the Marshaw, right there on the Talmud, just makes one remark and says, if they're really chachamim, if they're really wise people, understanding people, and no, they will not go into competition right close to the other ones. They just should not have to rely on a motive of jealousy or of envy to raise the standard of another school. But the general principle is that kinas seifrin tar b'chachma. I found the most interesting case when we talk about, let's say, it happens where there are synagogues. You have a shul. And it seems sometimes synagogues multiply only in one place. There could be one street that, in Europe, they used to have things that they called the shulhaif. It was the court of the synagogues. You could walk down the street and you see several shulim. And when we visited Vilna, it was pointed out to us where the original street of synagogue, there was one after another. There wasn't a question of competition. Each one probably had its own role the way it was. In Chicago now, we have certain streets that within a 2-3 block area, we have 5 synagogues. 5 functioning synagogues of different nature. But no one ever brought a lawsuit or a case into Besden because of the opening of another synagogue, which each one was a different type, or, well, we would use the lack of a better term, catered to a different group of people. Some people who originally didn't like that only synagogue, oh, now we have some place where we feel more comfortable. So they went there. So there's room for all of them. That's all part of the kin of suffering. However, I found an interesting response in the works of a famous rabbinic decisor who was himself a Hasidic rabbi, the Sochachov Rebbe, or Avraham Bornstein Zal, who lived in the last part of the 19th century and into the 20th century. He has a massive collection of responsa, considered not just as a Hasidic leader, but a rabbinic giant, a great rabbinic decisor and thinker. So in his tshuvas, the Avni Nezer, he has a tshuva where someone has a private synagogue. Why is it a private synagogue? What's a private synagogue? This was a synagogue, he says, of about 100 years old that was established by another Hasidic rabbi. And now his grandson was in there and was continuing the Masorah, the tradition of prayer and learning that was there in that synagogue. So someone else, what happened? Someone else who used to daven worship in that shul, and that's the Nat Beis Medrash of the Rebbe, went to and had a private house, and he opened up a minyan in a shul in his house. So what happened was the rabbinic, the grandson who inherited the synagogue from his grandfather, he protested. He brought the case to the Baal Avni Nezer. But what he did also, he reported it was under the Russian government of the Tsar at that time. He reported it to the government because the government did not allow any opening, at least it seemed in that place. This was Russian Poland. Did not allow the opening of a shul without some sort of a license or payment of a fee. So he reported it, he said, to the gubernia, to the provincial capital. So the case came before the Avni Nezer to rule upon. So in this case, he said, if it's a private, and he makes no bones about it, he just says it as a matter of passing. Today, sometimes we might think it's pretty horrifying. He said, this was a private synagogue. It was his parnasa. It was his living. That's the way it was. He owned the synagogue. It wasn't a community synagogue that had, you know, officers and a board and what you call people that controlled it, whatever it was. But he was the sole owner, the original Rebbe and his grandson who inherited. So it's like almost compared to like a business thing. And the other one, by opening up that place, is that not only, and he used to actively take some of the mispalim, the worshippers, used to come there, says, come to my place and come there. So he felt that he was wrong in doing that. That case will not apply the principle which you apply in Jewish schools or Jewish institutions, such whether synagogues or yeshivas or Talmud Torahs, of kinnas seifrin tar b'chachma. That was a private matter, and then since it was that private matter, therefore it was a question that was he went around that situation. As far as reporting to the government, he said he's not a, could be considered a musur or informer, which is a very terrible title of informing to the secular government about and bring it into the courts, because that was part of the rule of law that everyone basically obeyed over there. So he said he was not a transgressor in that particular situation. So these are some of the cases that deal with both competition and restrictive covenants. Now, Professor Levine not only has in this work, which is a rather large work of the moral issues in the marketplace of Jewish law, he had a previous work, talks about cases in Jewish law, they're dealing with ethical considerations. He also has there a chapter about the question of competition or ruining someone else's business. He even discusses in another case about ticket scalpers and so forth, that someone has already arranged a concert and he's selling, he got a block of 8,000 tickets and he's selling them at a very reasonable price. So someone comes along, an entrepreneur, and goes to the ticket agency there and sends people one after another to buy tickets. Then those chevra raise the price. They raise it up from $15, something like, to $40. And then what they do is, later on, they go around hawking. They wait till very close to the time of this concert, and which was supposed to be sold out, and they're hawking their tickets. They can sell them for $100, $200, whatever it is. Meanwhile, the other fellow is really like has lost on his, he thought of making a certain amount of profit on the ticket sales. He lost on it. So he describes that from the standpoint of Jewish law and the other one had done all the publicity for the concert, his labor, his toil, his arrangements to make of hiring the hall and everything else, is going to lose out. So there's a principle, you can't do business with somebody else's property or someone else's goods and take away from his toil. It's not a case where the Talmud many times says, well, you can do certain things for a neighbor as long as, although you might get profit, as long as he doesn't lose. But in this case, he was going to lose being in control of all the tickets that he should have had and all the profit that he had of it. So that's one of the cases that he discussed in the other book there, which I've enumerated, I believe, on page 72 to 74, where he discusses that particular case. So these are some of the examples, again, of the question of competition or so forth. We have to understand that in the American system, now, if you went to the American public school, raised in the American society, which I originally was, you got the idea that America is based on rugged individualism, that you go out into the marketplace and you make money. That's the ideal, no matter what the competition is. And that's why, strange thing, some of the great fortunes that are today the big philanthropists were raised on the basis of cutthroat competition. They eliminated everybody else, no matter what they do, whether they cut all the prices, whether they took control of other facilities where the other one couldn't enter and buy the product in order to sell it. All a lot of these great things. So that generally, however, we've come to understand and is written by many people, that there has to be fair play, at least in the marketplace. I mean, that's a sort of an ideal. Sometimes there will be groups that will deal with business ethics on that basis in order to make some element of fair competition. United States, just to editorialize on it, is in the grips of a cartel in oil that controls the whole economy, really, to some extent, of the United States and other worlds, the way they fix the price of oil, everything else of that sort. And no one talks about unfair things. If, as it happened years ago, the heads of certain corporations met in a hotel, amongst them, I believe, was General Electric, to fix a price on certain product. And later on, when they were caught, it was called collusion and conspiracy and breaking the law to control that marketplace in that way. But an international level, you have this. So here we have the Torah is concerned about many things. The Torah is concerned about not destroying an individual's parnasa, kapasuk the chiyuse, taking away parnasa. Or there's another element, which one of the texts is in here, but there's not time to go on about it, where an individual is about to make a sale to a certain customer, someone comes along and just takes it out from right under his nose, and the other one is left out after he put in all the effort to do that. That's called Oni Hamahape Bichwara. That's the poor person that used a very simple example who is about to pick up a cookie, a bread, and someone comes and grabs it away from it. That's wrong. That's considered, he's called a rasha. He's called a wicked person. He has that type of title that which even would play a role in Jewish law. So that's also something which the Talmud, which the Gemara and Biddick sources are. The main thing is that there has to be, and that was forgotten many times, that just what we recall in the ritual areas of Jewish law, when we think of the Sabbath, when we think of the Tefillin and all the other things that we observe on holidays, we try to be meticulous. The same thing has to be a strong ethical basic component in dealing with other people in a matter of business. That's the way we raise the ethical level of society, and we raise the level of Bein Adam L'Chaver, between one person and another, on the highest level. And that would be a proper, wonderful, moral Jewish community.
I'd like to close this morning and thank Rabbi Schwartz and Rabbi Gries. Anybody who has any questions regarding